across America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Carmen Page.
Writing for Focus on the Family, Glenn Stanton says no-fault divorce subjected an entire generation of children and their parents to a massive, untested social experiment fueled by adult wish fulfillment. We entered this experiment with no idea of how it would turn out. We bolstered ourselves with hopeful assumptions that if adults could easily exchange bad marriages for good, we would have happier, more self-actualized adults who would parent happier, more self-actualized children. Love would see us through. It was all, I'm okay, you're okay. And like disco and leisure suits, it seemed like it was a good idea at the time. And if this hopeful tinkering were without consequences for people and society, it would raise no real concern. All we would be talking about is mere opinion or preference. But that's not what's happened. 30 years of experience with millions of divorced adults and children proved our hopes horribly wrong. Studies reveal that large numbers of these adults are less secure, experiencing failing physical and mental health, unable to pull their lives together, entering affairs, cohabiting relationships that are just as troubled, and disposing literally of marriage. Domestic violence has increased dramatically. Some entered new marriages that broke up faster and as tragically as the previous one. Happiness was elusive. And children, they fare even worse. It's our subject today. It's a heavy one. And certainly, no doubt, to many in our audience, you may be thinking we are really opening a can of worms here. But I pray that you will stay with us, that you'll listen closely, not only to the stories of those whose lives have been affected, but to those who can bring us some legal insight to the table so that we can know what steps we can do to reverse this horrible travesty that's taken place in America. I am so pleased today to have with me as a co-host, Michael Craven. He is the founding director of Center for Christ and Culture. He is considered a leading cultural apologist, offering a rational biblical perspective in response to the various culture forces that seek to reshape the philosophical consensus in America. And we have had Michael on this program many times, not only as a guest, but as a co-host. And Michael, thanks for taking time to be with me today.
Carmen, as always, I am delighted to be here.
Well, and too, this is a subject that I know that you can speak personally to as a child of divorced parents, and I can speak to the subject because I was a divorced woman. So I have we are bringing that insight, personal insight, and we certainly are vulnerable and transparent as we share because we want our audience to really understand that we do know where we're coming from and where you're coming from in this issue. And more importantly, we're bringing our guest to the table for this hour. Our guest is Judith Brumbaugh, and she is the president and founder of Restoration of the Family, Inc., a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to establish, strengthen, and restore biblical families. Now, Judith is a professional educator, having taught the high school, community college, and four-year college level. She reaches families worldwide through the many publications that she's written on marriage-related topics. She writes and publishes a bi-monthly newsletter called Restoration Report, designed to strengthen and rebuild families and counsel with adults and children on a regular basis. And of course, Judith has been a guest on several national and local radio television programs. When asked to sign a divorce decree that said she was no longer married, Judith refused and was evicted from her home, having to leave her children and the family assets with her husband. She began an 8-year process of writing her own legal briefs to defend the permanence of marriage, both from a religious and constitutional point of view, as she documented legal precedents to show that such a decree violated not only God's law, but also the U.S. Constitution. And now she's written a book called Judge, Please Don't Strike That Gavel on My Marriage. Judith, we welcome you to Point of View to share your story.
Well, thank you, Carmen. It is a blessing indeed to be able to share this with the audience.
Well, you know, oftentimes I have found that it is in my own pain and suffering, whether that came because of choices that I had made or whether if I had been a victim of those choices. I found that by ministering to others, Judith, it also helped in my own healing process. And I would imagine you've experienced that as well.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, God gives us an example in His Word of so many of His prophets who likewise did that.
Yes.
You know, Hosea experienced the same thing.
Sure, sure.
And
Michael, I know, again, you come to the table with a voice of experience as well.
I do. My parents divorced when I was a child, and in hindsight, I was able to reflect on that experience and really glean from it its profound impact that it had in my life, and could no longer be deceived by this myth that that children endure, children survive, children overcome, this diminution of the impact of divorce on children, because I experienced it firsthand.
And Judith, your book, Please Don't Strike That Gavel, was your hope, how are you hoping that your readers would use this book?
I'm hoping to open their eyes to what is happening in the courts, what is happening to families, and also to alert the judicial system, the legislative system, that we must have a change.
We are going to have Attorney Shelby Sharp on in our second hour to bring some of the legal sides of the issue of no-fault divorce to the table. But you've experienced this personally, and through your research, you bring a lot of insight to the table from a layperson's perspective on what one individual can do to try to change the course of history on a law such as no-fault divorce. Even though you've not had a lot of success in doing so, you have made some headway that many of our listeners may not realize is even possible. If we could just briefly, Judith, give us a little bit of background on the process that you have taken since the divorce papers were served to you.
Well, I basically, first of all, fell on my knees before the Lord, and He showed me from the scriptures what marriage really was all about. We had a very happy marriage. We were a team that did things together. We were leaders in the church. And so it wasn't that I came from a terrible marriage. And God just showed me that marriage, according to His perspective, is until death you do part. And as I searched the scriptures, I found more and more about that. And when I was asked to sign a piece of paper that said that God's word was not true, that I was no longer a married woman, that created a lot of issues, needless to say. The court was not ready for it. And I, needless to say, wasn't ready for what happened after that, all of the issues that happened legally. As I went from court to court and from issue to issue.
As I was reading your book, and something you just said a few minutes ago really struck me, and that was you said that you learned what marriage was all about through studying God's Word. And it seems to me that this is a fundamental understanding that has been so profoundly lost in our culture today, which ultimately serves to facilitate the easy dissolution of marriage and ultimately its ultimate expression being no-fault divorce. I'd like you to expand on that a little bit in terms of recovering this true biblical understanding of marriage as opposed to the culture's contemporary understanding of marriage.
Well, I think one chapter in the book where I discuss the difference between a covenant and a contract helps people to understand some of this. We have to look at marriage from both aspects because not everybody is a Christian. We realize that. But we know that God creates a covenant, and that covenant cannot be changed by anything that man does. We make a lifetime commitment to this other person. That is something that the state considers to be a contract. And even with the state considering it a contract, they do not in the court honor that contract as they do all other contracts. getting back to the Word of God, you know, he started out in Genesis with a marriage between Adam and Eve. And God took the rib out, which we know. He made a woman, brought her unto man, and Adam said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And it's what therefore God hath joined together that God tells us, don't separate it. Because he knows what's best. He knows all the messes that we are seeing today because we don't honor that. And that theme is carried throughout the Bible. The Old Testament is showing God's relationship to Israel, his marriage to Israel, and how Israel disobeyed and went to other gods. And God keeps saying, return to me, backsliding children. And all the things that happened to the Israelites that is also happening to people today in their own personal marriages.
And one of the things it seems to me, Judith, is that today, sadly, because we have so taken away the value of marriage, the covenant between a man and a woman and God, God is not part of the marriage. They may be part of the wedding. They may be married by a pastor. They may share scripture. They, you know, may sing the Lord's Prayer. But after that, it seems that the Lord is not central to their marriage. And so there's nothing binding that's holding them in their minds, and it seems easier for them to turn. And I thought it was interesting you noted that even your husband acknowledged to the judge, he says, Judy has resisted the divorce on a religious basis. She will accept a separation but not a divorce. And of course, you were saying both he and you had based your marriage and your lives on a religious basis, what God said about marriage. But you then realized that that he and the government defined your marriage as a legal contract, and that they weren't following, though, what those contracts said, either the rulers over your marriage and its acquisitions, the Bible and the United States Constitution. And so you point out how those just seem to be trivially set aside without seriously considering what it means when you make a covenant with God.
Right, or when you make a contract. You know, people who don't go along with covenant, the contract is the same thing. It's supposed to be an enforceable contract, you know, and our Constitution says that we are not to impair the obligations of a contract. And so with either of these, we're not being taught. You know, our churches have failed us greatly because they are not teaching from the pulpit what God's Word says about marriage.
Right, right. Well, and I think that truly is part of the problem that we have today, Michael, is that it seems that the pulpits are silent on the issue of marriage, certainly on the issue of divorce. And I know, having been divorced before, my husband as well, when we go to churches, we look to see if they have divorce recovery ministries because that's where we teach now. And I'm often surprised at how many churches don't even address those who have gone through divorce to address the healing that needs to take place there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that part of it, there is so much hurt out there, and they may be feeling that, you know, I don't want to hurt these people, I don't want to say this, I don't want to say that. And not telling people is not going to solve the problem.
Exactly.
Right, and you're talking about one of the three most important institutions in culture, created by God. And you're absolutely right. It is the one thing that the church is saying less and less about. I know all too often there are classes involved in churches that attempt to prepare couples for marriage, and in many cases you have these couples living together, and yet the church never intervenes, never attempts to address this condition, just sort of winks at it and moves on. And this certainly is not reversing the present trend toward the demise of marriage.
And, you know, even a study of the Word will show people what true love is really about. You know, they look at feelings rather than commitment. And, you know, 1 Corinthians 13, I like to often refer to that. The word in the King James Bible says it's charity. And when you think of charity, you think you give it away and you expect nothing in return. And that's kind of the love that we have to get instilled in people, that, you know, you need to love this person and not expect something from them.
Right. Love is an act of the will.
Right.
It's not a romantic or exclusively romantic or sentimental feeling. It's an act of the will.
Yes, yes.
We know that that's a part of it. You know, we all have those feelings of love. But, I mean, the real essence is what you've said, Michael. And it's the commitment that you have to decide no matter what happens, I am committed to this relationship, and I will work it out. It isn't just staying together, but it's actively learning to communicate with the other person and to have some give and take and understand their feelings and their wants and their desires and not just a selfish look at it.
Right. I think somebody, a wise man once said that there are three reasons for divorce: selfishness, selfishness, selfishness.
True.
Yes. Yes.
And Carmen, you mentioned earlier that there was nothing binding in the minds of many people that prevent them or inhibit them from exercising divorce as an option. And that speaks directly to Coulson's Law, where he says where there is less internal conscience, there will be the need for greater external enforcement.
Yes.
And that's what we're seeing is the elevation of self and self's desires over and above virtue.
What's interesting about the whole discussion on divorce, I think, is, like you say, it's truly about self. And yet when no-fault divorce laws came into being, it was all about, well, it was going to make it easier. Perhaps it would open up doors for reconciliation because there wouldn't be so much bickering and fighting. It was going to be easier for the children because mom and dad weren't fighting. They were just amiably agreeing to go separate ways. And yet, truly, it has ended up being an experiment on our children. And Michael, you'd be able to speak this more than anyone, but I know my adult children will talk about the devastating effects on the divorce in their lives. And anything that you read from adult children of divorce will tell you that the experiment has failed. And Judith, I know that you mentioned as well that you have children who are grown, and I wonder how they have been brought into this discussion on the impact of your divorce.
Well, I think that they just, you know, they know. They've lived through it, and all the years of what has happened. Divorce does not end with a divorce. You know, divorce never ends. The relationships are still there. There's still a mom and a dad.
Yes.
And it is an absolute nightmare on the children, and we're seeing it at younger and younger ages, and it's having an incredible destructive impact on the children.
You did something, Judith, that most people don't do, and that is that you took it upon yourself with the Lord's help to fight for your marriage, fight beyond what most people are willing to do, one, because of the sheer cost, the time and the resources that are needed to do this. I'd like to hear a little bit about that struggle that you went through, some of the maybe successes, some of the failures in it.
Well, I actually did three things at one time. I looked at the judicial, the legislative, and the executive branch. I was trying every avenue I could. Through the legislative avenue, I introduced a bill to amend the no-fault divorce law. In the judicial area, I kept appealing the decree, which I feel was fraudulent because they did not meet the qualifications to even have jurisdiction over my case. I appealed that all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then, of course, I also appealed to the President of the United States by writing a brief to him. So I used all of those avenues to try to move, you know, somebody to hear what is being said.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this time I did not have an attorney because I was forced to release my attorney. And so I had to operate in a court system where I was not trained. And it's interesting that criminals are given the option of being provided an attorney if
exactly.
they're going to be incarcerated.
Yes.
And someone fighting for their family is just left out there to flounder and try and figure out what's going on, which I had a hard time doing.
And now you had to give it up, I assume, for financial reasons, Judith, because of the sheer expense?
There were a couple issues. In the lower court, initially when I said that I would not sign, the judge said, if you're not going to sign and you're going to contest this, which I didn't even realize what contesting would involve, then you'll have to do two things. You'll need to release your attorney today, and you'll need to move out of your home and let your husband move back in. So I was without an attorney for quite a while there in trying to file a motion for rehearing, which had to be done within a few days. I had no attorney. I was calling attorneys, trying to find someone who would represent me because I didn't have funds to hire another attorney.
Sure.
And so I had to figure out how to file this on my own. And I finally did hire another attorney quite some time later. But that attorney ended up asking the judge to be removed from my case because I didn't have money to pay him, which, you know, I can understand. A person wants to be paid, but I was in the middle of all of this paperwork and didn't know what to do. But if I'd been a criminal, I would not have to have done that.
Wow.
And in the book, I mention a criminal case where someone was definitely guilty of a crime, was incarcerated. And not only did the government give this man a free attorney, but they gave him an attorney who became, a couple of years later, a Supreme Court judge.
Mm-mm-mm.
So they didn't just give him someone who was beginning his career in law, but they gave him a top-rated attorney. But when we're looking to defend the family, you have no such thing as that.
That's right. Michael?
You know, Judith, in reading your book, I was so struck by the, as you illuminated, the series of events that unfolded at the hands of the courts. And it seems even to the casual layperson that so many of these actions are in direct violation of our long understood, long held constitutional rights. Why is it, do you think, that this no-fault divorce practice remains so popular and still in effect today?
Well, a lot of people are not really aware of what's going on. That's one issue. Even people who worked with me through this, when they read the book, they said, I had no idea all this was going on in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is that people don't realize that it violates the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, there's a lot of, we know that no fault has a huge industry behind it. It is a multi-billion dollar industry. The government alone spends $46 billion a year on issues that they have stated have been created or exacerbated by the breakup of families and marriages. $46 billion a year.
Wow.
And that does not include all the attorneys, all the social workers that are attached to this industry.
Mm. Well, and that's like you say, and then the effects of the counseling and the health issues and all of those things that are just mountain expenses. And as you point out, it really has become a business, and it's hard to find someone who deems that it's in their best interest to help protect marriage.
Right.
And, so that's what you're up against. And mm-hmm. you continue to really just not be given support from any of the levels that you took it to, whether it be judicial, legislative, or the executive, right?
Absolutely. No support at all. It was just a lot of gymnastics loops that you have to go through, and then you find out, well, I did this wrong because I didn't follow this rule book. And, you know, each area has a different rule book to follow. You know, there's just so many rights that are voided and invalidated. You know, because someone no longer wants to live with you, how should the court have a right to take your property away? How should the court have a right to take your children? And I don't know what all the answer is to this. Nobody does at this point. But, you know, the time does have to be divided between the parents.
Yes.
And this is because of a unilateral decision that is made by someone who does not want to honor a commitment.
Yeah, that's really unilateral is the key word there, isn't it? No fault is somewhat of a misnomer. It's really a unilateral divorce on demand.
Right. That's and it's interesting that when this was initially passed, what it was billed as, the parties must mutually consent to the dissolution of the marriage in order to have a no-fault divorce.
Yeah.
But we know that hasn't happened.
You know, Judith, I would ask you, how would you respond to those who advocate on behalf of no-fault divorce under the argument that it is a more humane approach to divorce?
Well, I don't know how it can be humane when you strip all the rights from one of the persons to begin with.
Right.
And you are speeding up the number of people who are coming through the courts and children who are living in single-family homes. Because there's, you know, everyone knows that searches this out, that they don't have to have any reason to go away from the marriage. All they have to do is come in and say, my marriage is irretrievably broken. And the court then just brings the gavel down. They say they are irreconcilable differences. However, it's interesting that studies have been done that every single marriage, and I think we know this, has irreconcilable differences.
Of course.
And, you know, you talk to anybody, there are things that they do not agree about. So you are being convicted of a quote-unquote crime. It would be like saying, everybody breathes. Now, Judith, because you breathe, I'm going to fine you, you know, $50,000.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I have no way to defend that or say, you know, I don't breathe.
I was reading, Judith, in a paper by Divorce Resource Center that says, simply stated, this new system of divorce, speaking of no-fault divorce, where no complaint is filed and therefore no defense is possible, serve to overturn the rule of law in this country, whereby a remedy can only be offered when a complaint is stated. It says to be forced to forfeit something of value, like marital status, time with your children, property, etc., is considered unconstitutional under these circumstances. So if you've been served divorce papers, you need to understand that you're being drawn into a process that is unconstitutional. I assume that you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I'm sure it's encouraging for you to know that you're not the only one that's out there trying to let people know this, because I can imagine how lonely you must have felt as you went through this process, battle after battle, feeling that you were the only one who even cared.
Yes, it was hard to find anyone who would, you know, open up the door for help and to guide me and help me and support me. And so this is true. This is good that this will open up avenues to let people know there are other ones, and we need to get together and do something about what's going on.
Yes. And, Michael, do you find that this is a topic of discussion in your work at Christ and Culture?
Absolutely. I think, obviously, the topic of marriage is on the forefront of cultural discussion and debate today as we contemplate such things as same-sex marriage. And there was an outstanding article written by Stephen Baskerville, who's a professor at Howard University, and he makes this salient point. He said the problem today is not gay couples wanting to get married. The threat to marriage is straight couples not wanting to get married or not staying married.
Exactly.
He says the demand to recognize same-sex marriage is clearly a symptom of how weakened marriage has already become.
Yes. And I thought he did. He made some excellent points, because when we all have deep concerns, and rightfully so, about same-sex marriage, we have to figure out where the disinterest in stabilizing heterosexual marriages, what happened there. And when you look back, no-fault divorce certainly had a tremendous negative influence on our marriages and the way we feel about a commitment to marriage. And when you desensitize the values that we hold dear, then certainly it opens the door for most any arrangement, relationship to be formed.
Well, and as Professor Baskerville points out, the institutional strength of marriage is determined not by the words through which a marriage is formed, but rather by the deeds through which a marriage is dissolved, which is what we're here talking about today.
That's right. Well, we do have some listeners that want to join the discussion. Let's go to Tim in Texas. Hi, Tim. You're on Point of View.
Hi, Carmen.
Hi, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I just had a quick comment. My hat's off to Judith, and I'm so thankful she's willing to stand up for marriage and take a stand. I know she's probably taken some hits for doing that, and I just want to let her know that my hat's off to her, and I thank her.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you for calling, Tim. Let's go to Mary in Missouri. Hi, Mary. You're on Point of View.
Yes. Hi. Am I on right now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I just want to commend you, Judith, for the book. I'm someone that my husband wanted out of the marriage. I also didn't know anything about God's will, about covenant and marriage, but was praying, and God led me to a prayer group, and they shared that with me. So I got remarried, and all I did was stand on the Word of God, and my husband didn't want nothing to do with me. Not at all. So I want to say, right on, keep going. And we need to also hear the end result, which is God is a God of restoration. As long as he's still standing in the gap for Israel, and she's the one, I believe, if you want to talk about committing adultery, you didn't, but a lot of people that are going through divorces is because of that's one of the reasons. Nobody committed adultery more on their husband than Israel did with God, and he's still standing in the gap for her. And he said he's married to her. So anyway, God bless you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. Let's go to Tim in Louisiana. Hi, Tim. You're on Point of View.
Hi. I just want to know, does the Bible give any grounds for divorce?
I have found none. A lot of people misconstrue Matthew 19:9, but remember that God says, no more twain. No more means what? Forever.
And Judith, I wanted to see, as we are in our closing moments with you, if you have some advice for those who are listening of how they might get involved in your efforts to restore marriage to one man, one woman for life, and that we might somehow overturn or reform no-fault divorce laws.
There are a lot of people who are interested in doing this, and if you want to contact me at my website, which is www.restorationofthefamily.com, we're trying to gather the people together who are wanting to do something about the family, and we will contact you back. But there are, there are legislators, there are judges. You know, there are judges who don't want to put the gavel down, but because of the law, they are forced to do so. There are attorneys who want to do something. Shelby Sharp is a good example who's coming on. There are a lot of people who want to do something, and it's the doers of the word that God is looking for. So please do something.
Definitely so. And we've been talking with Judith Brumbaugh, the author of Judge, Please Don't Strike That Gavel on My Marriage. You can learn more about Judith and her book and her organization by going to pointofview.net and click on our guest spotlight, and we have more information there. Judith, I just pray the Lord will continue to bless your efforts and just bless you and your family. And I know that your work will bring comfort and hope to a lot of listeners in our audience who take advantage of getting a copy of your book. So thank you for taking this time for us today.
And thank you for having me on.
And we are pleased to have join us our guest attorney, Shelby Sharp. He received his doctorate in law from the University of Texas School of Law. With more than 40 years of litigation experience involving federal and state constitutional issues, he is a member of Sharp, Reynolds, Tillman & Melton in Fort Worth, Texas. In Shelby's endorsement of the book, Judge, Please Don't Strike That Gavel on My Marriage, he says, no-fault divorce is the most devastating event that has ever occurred in American history by any measurement. Shelby, welcome. And I tell you, that's a powerful statement to make about a book, and I know you wouldn't have made it if you didn't mean it.
Well, that's true. And I didn't come to that conclusion lightly without a tremendous amount of research and study on the impact of no-fault divorce.
Mm. And why would you say that it is one of the most devastating?
Well, let's measure it by these criteria. Since 1970, when America began to go down the no-fault divorce route, you've had a destruction of over 1 million families annually. You have reduced millions of women and children to the poverty level and below annually, and the need for government assistance of all kind for these millions has increased significantly. You have a significant impact on public education, where almost all your remedial programs have children from divorced families. You have a significant increase in the dropout rate of children from schools. The trial court system has at least doubled because of having to handle no-fault divorce. Then you've got the expenditure of crime. The people being handled by the criminal justice system, the vast majority of them are coming from these situations. And then just the economic loss from work of people who miss work because of no-fault divorce. And then you've got the health issues. So if you did an impact study or an environmental study, as they do on a lot of things, and you applied that to this, there is no legislature that could look at all this and say, you know, this is a wise piece of legislation.
No kidding. Michael?
Well, it's interesting to me that the weight of the evidence is so overwhelming, and yet we sort of maintain this collective blindness to this blight in our country that is institutionalized in our legal system, which raises the question, are there any moves underfoot to reform no-fault divorce legislation?
I think some of the states have begun to look at this situation and are toying with various approaches to try to deal with it. Seems to me that I think there's a two-tiered system being considered or may have even passed not too long ago where you can go one route and it ends in no-fault divorce, and then you can have a covenant-type marriage that the covenant's going to be enforced.
I would be interested to know, Shelby, your opinion on the covenant-type marriages. I know there was a lot of controversy, even within conservative circles, whether or not that was a good thing, since certainly those who are Christians would believe that all marriage is a covenant marriage between them and God. But from a legal standpoint, is that a step in the right direction?
Well, here again, it just depends on your point of view. But you are correct, Carmen, in that the Scripture says very plainly that marriage is a covenant, and you've got a multitude of court decisions out there that have acknowledged that it is a covenant. And to me, when you're going to enter into a relationship that is the foundational institution for every society that ever exists, you should have that institution not only honored but protected by law. And two willing people entering into the marriage relationship should be able to make a covenant that the court should enforce.
You know, it's in reading Judith's book, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm a layman, but I could not help but be struck by what could only be described as tyrannical action on the part of our court system against citizens. Which begs the question, has the constitutionality of no-fault divorce ever been tested or challenged?
Yes, it has been challenged, but it has never made its way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And I am convinced that if it ever gets to the Supreme Court of the United States, if the court properly applies the requirements of due process, it goes down because it fails in two essential elements. Due process says that if you're going to lose a right that the Constitution considers to be a fundamental right, and the Supreme Court of the United States has held that marriage is such a right, one, you are entitled to notice that it's going to happen. Well, it satisfies that. You're entitled to an attorney. It satisfies that. You're entitled to be able to use the resources of the court to call witnesses and to present evidence. It meets that. But here's where it fails. To establish either a lack of merit or a legal bar, and you can do neither of those. When you file a suit for no-fault divorce, if there is a marriage and the court has jurisdiction, it is always granted. Some years ago, back in the 80s, I had an opportunity to take a case. And in that case, we submitted affidavits from a cross-section of the 254 counties in Texas concerning divorces that had been filed since no-fault went into effect. And I think we filed like 175 from the clerks that handled those cases. And here's what was unanimously in the evidence. The evidence said that every no-fault divorce that was filed where the court had jurisdiction and there was a valid marriage, that none was denied. Zero. Now, I don't know too many lawyers that handling other kinds of matters never, ever lose a case, or that the court never, ever rules in favor of the opposite side. But in no-fault divorce, the person seeking it is always going to get it.
Well, that is so true. You know, I think about how conservative groups and pro-family groups, church groups, have joined together in unity to fight the issue of same-sex marriage. And I can't help but think that if they had been aware of the outcome of no-fault divorce back in the late 60s, that perhaps this would not have come about, and we would not have had 30 years of an experiment that has failed. And yet, it really has sort of set the stage to usher in the likes of same-sex marriage, hasn't it?
Carmen, to some degree it has. But you have to go back to a more fundamental change in society's attitude towards just the institution of marriage itself. And you also have to understand what was being argued in favor of changing from the fault system that we'd had in the United States from its inception. You will recall back in the 60s, there was a change in attitude towards marriage and towards freedom in general. Freedom was being redefined as the right to do whatever you wanted to do, and to not be permitted to do what you wanted to do was not freedom. And that was totally contrary to the way marriage was examined in the United States, because it was considered one of those relationships that was so important that it was protected by the courts for the protection of children and society. And that to not do this was an absolute detriment to society. In fact, Chief Justice Hemphill in 1848, the first Supreme Court of Texas, described what would happen if marriage could be ended in the manner in which no fault is. And no fault, of course, wasn't even on the horizon then. And what he described is exactly what we have today. Now, how did no fault get its nose in the tent? It was promoted on the basis that we don't need contention in divorces, that this fault system causes people to act ugly towards each other, and we need to get that out of there, because if a marriage is coming to an end, we need to try to promote as much harmony as possible, and this will help the parties to maybe work through it and get reconciled and not go through a divorce at all. Well, prior to no fault coming in, the divorce rate in the United States was at its lowest level ever. But since it came in, yeah, you've taken the antagonism out of the actual legal proceedings, but now you've just exploded the divorces because there's no way to stop it.
That's right.
And in so doing, diminished the value of marriage itself, or the institution of marriage.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, while it is the most important institution of every society, now in our country, it is no longer important at all. Another interesting historical fact about this is that when Lenin took over in Russia, he knew that he could only maintain power by force for a limited period of time. And if he didn't destroy the Russian family and then reconfigure society below him, he would have no chance. And he, in effect, instituted a no-fault divorce system where all you had to do if you didn't want to be married was just simply send a postcard to the local registrar and you were divorced. And that was his means of trying to destroy the marriage and then also to get the woman out of the house and to leave the upbringing of children to people other than the mother and having a stable mother and father family.
Well, and that's an interesting historical precedent, because it offers us a very condensed framework to gain some insight into the impact of changing the structure or definition of marriage.
That's right.
Exactly.
Because there were a lot of changes that the Communist Party under Lenin made with regard to the control of sexual ethics.
Right.
The dissolution of marriage was just one of those, but the legalization of abortion and polygamy and bigamy were permitted, all of these things. But the result of that was so catastrophic that the government was actually forced to reverse all of their earlier policies.
They had to reverse it to keep from the entire country from just coming apart. One of the other interesting things that Lenin did was the government promoted pornography, And if you will look at the change in the court decisions that have taken place in the United States, though they're some decades behind for all practical purposes, our government has now done the same thing that Lenin did, which was another part of helping to destroy the family.
Exactly. We were talking off the break or off the air earlier about the fact that the Kinsey Institute and Alfred Kinsey, his working certainly had a lot to do with all of this as well. And the idea of just the legalization that's taken place for pornography and adultery and sodomy, and it all can be linked back. It's almost like one big vicious ball, if you will. It seems all of these things are a part of it.
No question about it, and there's no doubt that Kinsey's conclusions and his supporting material have pretty well been proven to be totally fraudulent. In fact, I think the book that Marlon Maddox wrote that was published after his death probably has the best discussion of Kinsey and what he did and its impact on our culture.
Yes, and that's Public Education Against America, and we've certainly been talking about that as well. Well, I think some of our listeners might be surprised that California provided really the first breakthrough for this idea of no-fault divorce when then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed the Family Law Act in 1969. Of course, he later said that it was one of the worst mistakes that he ever made in office, but it was my understanding, what I've been reading, Shelby, is that he thought, or it was his understanding and intention, that there would be conciliation courts as part of this new law, and apparently that was a feature that was dropped right after the law was enacted.
Well, don't know whether it was dropped or not, but even in almost every state, they have a provision where that the court or a party can request such to try to get it resolved. But if one of the other parties just adamantly opposes it, as a practical matter, that feature is just of no effect.
Well, that makes sense. And then the attitudes today, they want no part of that because that affects their freedom, so they think.
Correct.
Not looking at the devastating effects. Let's get in a call or two before we go to a break, and let's go to Jeremy in Florida. Jeremy, you're on Point of View.
Yeah, I had a question about the father's rights. My wife has filed for divorce as soon as she got pregnant, and she plans to leave the country as soon as the baby's born. So is there something I can do to prevent that? With
Shelby, would that, he's from Florida, would that be, would he have to consider state's laws there?
Yeah, that's going to be dependent upon what the Florida Family Code says, and I am totally unfamiliar with the Florida Family Code, so you'd have to ask an attorney in Florida to get an answer to that question.
Okay, so the fact that she's in Ohio just complicates it even more.
That does complicate it even more, but wherever her residence was at the time of the marriage, and that's where y'all were, the fact that she may have moved to Ohio, that could run into all kinds of complications as to where a divorce would be filed and what court would have jurisdiction to prevent her from moving and taking the child. I do know that most states, and it may be all states, that whatever court would have jurisdiction over a suit for divorce, that court also has the power to control the movement of the husband and wife as it would affect children.
Jeremy, I hope that you will check with an attorney, but also go online. There are several organizations, pro-family organizations, that deal particularly with dads and the issue of divorce. And I know you might even check a local Florida Family Council might give you some direction on that as well. But we just pray the Lord will bless you during this time. Shelby, we were actually talking off break, and I think it's important to bring to our listeners' attention the idea that this that no-fault divorce really has some constitutional problems, doesn't it, and really interferes with the due process.
Yes, and it is because it is such an important right that the Supreme Court has found it constitutionally protected that to lose such a right, you can only lose it by due process. And as I pointed out in the earlier segment, there are two parts of it that it fails. But the most interesting thing to me is this. Abortion has come before the U.S. Supreme Court many times, but no-fault divorce has never been addressed by the United States Supreme Court. And I am convinced that if a case can ever get that far, and by that I mean if a client is willing to take it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, I'm convinced that when they apply their opinions on due process to this constitutionally protected right, there's no way they can say that it meets it, and it would knock them down all over the country and send us back to a false system that we had before those statutes took their place.
I think that's what's most surprising to me is, as I was reading in preparation for this, what no-fault divorce ultimately represents is unprecedented intervention into the private sphere of family.
That's correct.
Into law-abiding citizens who are not violating the law, yet it gives the state unprecedented control over that institution of family.
When it should be the reverse of that, the state giving support and protection to that institution.
Right.
It's amazing. I was reading an article by Stephen Baskerville on Fathers into Felons, and he was kind of talking along that same line of the idea that there is a realm of family life which the state cannot enter, according to Justice Byron White. But on the same token, that's exactly what happens when you have no-fault divorce. The state does enter, and sometimes property's taken away, children are taken away, wages are garnished. I mean, there's a lot of things that happened, and it really becomes an issue of a privacy issue as well.
It does that, and it's also interesting to note, Carmen, that back about in the mid-'80s, there was a congressional committee that was looking at women and poverty, and two witnesses that appeared before the committee were Gloria Steinem and Bev LaHaye, and they both were attacking no-fault divorce for the same reasons. Now, how often can you think of an issue where those two ladies were in agreement?
That's right. That's right. I can remember Beverly LaHaye talking about that and how they were rode in a cab together and couldn't agree on anything but that issue.
Right. And here you're taking so many women and children and reducing them below the poverty level. I know a lady in Colorado that is getting $300 a month for one child, and she'll get it for 3 years, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the child won't even be close to 18.
Wow.
I mean, that's unconscionable.
It is. It is. Matter of fact, I was reading an interview that Dr. Dobson had with a woman. He said, 47-year-old woman from Detroit who said instead of starting a career for herself, she helped her husband get his business started. She had four kids. She, you know, took care of him, took care of the house, took care of the kids. She kept her marriage vows. And then in midlife, she finds herself divorced, her husband making over $100,000 a year, and she's struggling to get by on a quarter of that, raising her children. More oftentimes than not, the woman, if the woman is the one who is the victim in that situation, she and her children will suffer more financially than the man does. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. The statistics are overwhelming that it's 90-something% that it's the woman and the children who take the economic hit.
I found it interesting when you consider that. I mean, I know there are men listening who have been the victims of divorce and who were thinking, oh, wait a minute, what about us? And I was also reading, Shelby, that divorce hurts men physically, emotionally. The suicide rate for divorced men is four times higher than that for women. Their need for psychiatric care is 10 times more than those who are married. So there's a physical and emotional crisis where men thereby suffer more.
Well, that was one of the things that I was mentioning in the first segment, is that the physical and emotional consequences on all parties to divorce are staggering. Male, female, children, they have more health problems, they have more emotional problems than those who come from families where there is no divorce.
So the personal as well as societal benefits to divorce just simply are not there.
They're not there. And there's nobody who can go out there and come forward with any evidence that a reasonable person could accept and say no-fault divorce is a blessing to this society. This society functioned very, very, very well under the fault system. And if you go back and look, the lowest level of divorces in the United States was just prior to no-fault divorce. Now, what did that mean? That meant we had stable families across this country, except in a very, very small percent. Were there certain circumstances where an individual was in a circumstance that staying in the marriage was unhealthy, or that they needed to separate or something like that? Sure, there are those situations. But when we held that you had to prove a fault, that the government says that's serious enough to dissolve the bands of matrimony, we had only 3-point-something percent divorces in the United States annually.
And this is an issue that affects every single one of us. And I want to remind our listeners what was said in the earlier hour, that the associated cost for families dissolving is around $46 billion per year.
It's staggering, and it's just in all respects. I mean, look at the impact on the criminal justice system,
yeah,
the people they're now handling. Look at the public schools and all the remedial courses that they have. These are not learning disabled kids. These are kids that are emotionally affected by divorce, and therefore that's why they need the remedial classes.
Of course, you didn't
have those remedial classes at the level you've got them now prior to no-fault divorce, and those remedial classes are now significant, and that's a huge economic impact.
Well, it truly is. And what can we do? What can citizens do? I know that grassroots activists are listening, and there have been great strides made in America on many issues because of individuals taking action. So what action can we take on the issue of no-fault divorce, Shelby?
The first thing that I would do is get your senators and representatives to just do a study on the impact of no-fault divorce within the particular state over a defined period of time. Just look at it like any other impact study. And then after getting the information on that, saying, is this something that is blessing our state, or is this something that is creating such horrendous consequences? We need to get rid of it. I think the fault system worked well in America. Its track record cannot be attacked. When you've got a great system and you go to something else that is a disaster, the wise thing to do is cut it out and go back to what worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one thing that is working is, and herein lies, I think, one of the great opportunities for the church in the 21st century, is a return to marriage preparation.
Yes.
Indeed.
There are some great programs out there that are having a profound effect in directly reducing divorce rates of communities.
That's right. I think of Marriage Savers.
Absolutely.
That comes to mind, and certainly there are others. And so there are roles that we can take as citizens. There are roles that we can take as members of a church congregation. Certainly things that our pastors and church staff leaders can do on this subject. But I think it's going to take all of us doing something at the same time, because really the squeaky wheel does get the grease. And regardless of whether you're talking to the courts or legislatively or to the executive branch, we do need to join together on this. We do have Shelby Sharp with us, and we are taking your calls. Let's go to Barbara in Texas. Hi, Barbara. You're on Point of View.
Oh, thank you. I would disagree with Shelby in regard to no-fault, that there shouldn't be a no-fault divorce, because and I think that millions probably of women would disagree as well, because women that are suffering from domestic violence usually do not have even a roof over their heads, much less the wherewithal and attorney fees to take a husband to a full-fledged trial in a court to get a divorce from him. And if you'll notice that the statistics before no-fault divorce, as far as women being killed by their husbands, was much higher. And so being a victim of domestic violence in the late 50s and early 60s myself, and knowing the price that had to be paid to bring a husband into a court, to prove domestic violence and non-support alcoholism, et cetera, was a 3 or 4 year ordeal, and of which my life was put on the line many times. So I think that no-fault divorce was specifically brought into law to give women that relief. I do realize that there should be some laws changed, but not regarding divorce, as far as any no-fault divorce does not affect child custody suits. They still go on in trials, and a good example of those trials is to show that it's the children that actually do suffer, because the trials on child custody run anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000, $40,000.
Laura, let's give Shelby an opportunity to respond to your first issue there. And first, my heart goes out to you for any woman who is a victim of abuse. And certainly we would encourage women to get out of an abusive situation. And Shelby, that was one of the reasons I know that no-fault divorce was encouraged because of the abuse issue. And I know there are many women who would share Barbara's views, but do statistics hold out overall in regard to do we see that it has been an advantage for those women?
Well, let me just say first off that abuse was a grounds for divorce under the fault system, and she acknowledged that. What she said the problem was the legal expense to get the divorce. That was a problem that the legal profession created, but not all lawyers created that, because there were lawyers that handled domestic relations matters before no-fault divorce, that when a woman came in an abusive situation and she didn't have the economics to do it, there were lawyers who still took her case. Now, unfortunately, there were lawyers out there who wouldn't do it. But that doesn't mean that the no-fault was the way to cure it. The way to cure it was to get the legal profession to help those, just like we do in any other kind of situation where somebody has a good, solid case, and we handle it pro bono or at a significantly reduced rate.
Yes.
So I think that going the no-fault route to try to cure an economic problem that was being created by the lawyers is not the solution. You deal with where the problem is, and that's with the lawyers of helping the clients who have the problem.
Yes, definitely so. Well, it's no doubt about it. Divorce has caused devastation, as you've mentioned in the beginning, Shelby, on millions of lives, whether it be the men, the women, the children. We know certainly abuse is something that must be stopped, and there are avenues for protection and what have you. And yet we still need to address this issue of no-fault divorce. And hopefully today we've at least been able to start a dialogue among our listeners, and perhaps with more education for ourselves, and if we take action together, perhaps we can make a difference. But Shelby Sharp, I thank you so much for your taking this issue to heart and working so persistently over the many, many years to make a change. And I appreciate you joining us here today on Point of View.
You're very welcome, and you have a good day.
Thank you, Shelby.